The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I just came back from teaching a retreat yesterday and at our retreat center. It was wonderful to be there, a very nice retreat to teach. I think part of me is still there, so I don't have anything new to talk about. So I'm going to offer something which is still lingering with me from this last week that remains meaningful for me, and I think meaningful for other people who hear this. And it has to do with a story that was printed in an e-newsletter by an organization called Insight Out. So like Insight Meditation. It's a kind of pun on Inside Out. Because it's the organization founded by Jacques Verdun, who did many years of work in the prisons in San Quentin, and then now has gone off to create an organization that does that kind of work more widely in other prisons and for people paroled. And so he has this e-newsletter for his organization, and in there he had a story written by one of the prisoners. So I would like to read this story for you. And the story is titled The Shining Fire Hydrant. My night was like any other night. It was 8 p.m., time for close custody count. All prisons have institutional counts wherein they count each prisoner's body to ensure no one is missing or has escaped. Not being there for a count is considered a serious violation. The officer came to our cell and called my cellmate's name. Cells in San Quentin are probably smaller in most of your bathrooms. If you've ever been in one, it's quite something. There's about the space that probably is about, I don't know, between the bunk and the wall, that's maybe 2.5 feet, you know, just kind of narrow passageway. And the end of the far end of the bunk is a metal toilet that has no lid and no seat. You sit because you don't want them to break it out and use it for something. And I guess maybe a sink. And so there's two bunks, toilet, and this narrow passageway. And you can't sit up in your bed because it's not enough space. And you can't sit up in the top bunk because there's not enough space to the ceiling. So this is the, you know, you share a room with someone. And so the guard is going down the gangway and looking at each cell, looking through the bars, and doing the count. So the officer came to our cell and called my cellmate gave him the last two digits of his prison number. The same went for me. Half an hour passed, and a neighbor comes to my cell and said they were paging me downstairs. I had not heard them calling for me. I went down to the podium, and the cops said to me, "Why were you not in your cell for count?" And I told them, "I was in my cell for count, as I have been every day and night for 12 years. And I have numerous neighbors that can verify that." It did not matter what I said. The cops told me to not do it again. And I am like, whatever. 2 days go by, and I find out that the sergeant gave me a write-up, a violation. I'm thinking, okay, I am truly not guilty of this, and I have many witnesses who will say the same. However, at the hearing, the cop that counted said he looked in the cell two times and I was not there. It did not matter what I said or how many people I had who would say the same, because I was found guilty and given 40 hours of extra work. I said to myself, screw this. I am not going to do the work. This is so unfair. I did nothing wrong. And these guys are wrong about this. I watched that count cop count me, and he did not look up from his count board once. His eyes never left that board. I filed a complaint against the officer. That is the last thing I wanted to do, but I was not wrong about this. They were. I felt bitter about being ordered to do those 40 hours of extra duty. In a phone call, I spoke to my mother about it, and she wondered if I could perhaps just take it, and regardless of the circumstances and the injustice of it, see if I could do what would ultimately be best for me. She said she would accept what I would decide, but if I could, to act respectfully. I reckoned if I refused to do the work, even though it came about unjustly, I would be guilty in their eyes. I chose to do the work anyway. I have always prided myself with doing exceptional work, and I was desperately looking to find my pride in this situation, somewhere, no matter what. So, not only did I do the work, I did the best possible job I could do. I was asked to shine up this brass fire hydrant. Though I felt resentful about those 40 hours of extra duty, I set off to shine up this hydrant, and I really got into the job. As a result, this hydrant started shining very brightly. As the sun caught it, I could see my face in it, and I noticed I was smiling from ear to ear. I began to laugh out loud for no reason other than enjoying that moment and seeing the result of my work. By putting all my conscious effort into shining up that fire hydrant, I had become bigger than the unfairness that led me to the assignment. I do not know how long I was at it, but when I was done, that hydrant, it looked like the prettiest thing in the whole prison. Kinda like a lighthouse standing proudly in an ocean of concrete, calling out on how to steer, on how to move through the place. I realized I was shining too, and it hasn't left me. Many people commented on that hydrant all week, wondering how come that thing gives off so much light all of a sudden. I just smiled. So it's a great story. I read the story last Monday here at IMC because it was a follow-up on a series of talks I gave on concentration practice. And I thought this was a nice kind of example of someone who got concentrated, kind of threw himself wholeheartedly into doing a particular job, and in just being fully present for there, and being able to somehow put aside his attitude, his concerns, his preoccupation that interfered with wholeheartedness. Putting aside that, letting go of it, and giving himself over, he started shining himself. He became the hydrant. He became the beacon. And what's very touching about this story, I think, also, is the idea that he was wronged. It was an injustice, what happened to him, seemingly. And he had to put aside his clinging to justice, to being right, in a situation where it's reasonable that he felt like he should be right. But in the prison, it was pointless for him to fight for what was right. If he kept fighting for that, he could have ended up in solitary confinement. Conditions there are not set up for justice. the prison guards have a tremendous power, and they want to keep things in line a certain way. And sometimes they abuse their power. So he had to let go of something in our ordinary life many of us are not willing to let go of, being right, but for a higher cause, for his own betterment. And so what about things we cling to which are not right? What about we cling to all kinds of things that interfere with our ability to give ourselves wholeheartedly to the task at hand, to what's needed, what's going on? And so he gave himself wholeheartedly to his fire hydrant. Do you have a fire hydrant? Do you have something that you're asked to do? Maybe something that you'd rather not do, but you need to do, you should do, maybe you're required to do. Do you have attitudes that get in the way? Do you have ideas of what's right and wrong? Do you have resentments? Do you have regrets? Do you have other things you want to do rather? But you have to do something. And is there a time and place where you're better off giving yourself over completely to that one task, but so fully that you begin smiling? And this is one of the little secrets that you learn from meditation practice, is that if you can give yourself over wholeheartedly to one thing, there's something about the way that the wholeheartedness and the unification, the gathering together of our mental and physical forces to work together in harmony, that evokes a strong sense of well-being. And what's nice about this well-being is it's not dependent on things going right in the world. It's just dependent on the quality of engagement, the quality of involvement in self, and the kind of one-pointedness or unified involvement with what we're doing. So he became, and it says in this beautiful story, he said he became bigger than the situation, bigger than the injustice. And this is one of the wonderful things that can happen when we give ourselves over completely to something, is that there's something about the quality of the mind or the heart where it tends to become more expansive and open. And we're no longer being defined by the circumstances, defined by our identity, defined by things, defined by our resentment, defined by what we're attached to. And this idea of not being defined, you know, it's our ideas and thoughts about things which limit us more often than not. And the wholehearted giving ourselves over to something so the definitions of ourselves fall away, the identities we have fall away, is part of what helps expand our sense of self, our sense of the mind, the heart. And we become bigger than the situation. When I was at Tassajara, the Zen monastery, there was a wonderful moment where, let's describe the, it was the whole year that led up to this moment. In September, I was assigned to work in the kitchen. I'd been at the monastery for 9 months, and I was asked to go work in the kitchen for the day. And I remember going into the kitchen that first day, and the kitchen seemed really big, and I felt really small. And then it turned out I was assigned to the kitchen for a whole year. And the following September, I knew it was a day I knew this was going to be my last day in the kitchen. I was going to be assigned somewhere else. And so because it was my last day in the kitchen, I kind of looked around the kitchen, kind of like I did the very first day a year before. And now the kitchen felt really small, and I was really big. And I had spent a year in the kitchen getting used to it, but not only that, I had learned that year in the kitchen to give myself over wholeheartedly to the kitchen itself. I didn't want to be there at first. I was a little bit resentful of being there. I was there at the Zen monastery to meditate, and serious meditation practice. And when you work in the kitchen at the monastery, you don't get to meditate as much as everyone else. And I was a new monk there, and what are they doing sending me now? They should send someone who's been here longer, and I'm here to meditate. And then, you know, I didn't want to do some of the work there. I didn't want to cut the carrots. You know, carrots are not very spiritual. And there, you know, there were like, I don't know how many people, 40 people to cook for. So like, there were a lot of carrots and onions too. In my first months there, I was just, mostly what I did was chopped. So I had a lot of carrots to chop and onions and stuff. And I remember that, you know, that I started tuning into my posture, and I noticed that my posture was often oriented towards the door. a way out. And twisted a little bit. And I learned to kind of twist myself back so I'd really face the carrot. And then after a while, it twist away, and I wasn't quite there, and kind of chopping with one hand, kind of like, and not really into it. And then I would kind of bring myself back, and there was to really be there wholeheartedly, just be there, to give myself over. It was my practice that year that I made was how to really be, give myself over fully to the task at hand. And after some months, I learned to be there with the carrots. My carrots and I became friends. And then I became given more responsibility in the kitchen, became a manager of the kitchen, and I kind of didn't have to really try so hard to be fully in the kitchen. It was like a job was just all-consuming. I just kind of gave myself over fully to it. And I loved it. It was a wonderful time for me. And I think that contributed to the idea of becoming bigger. And I became much bigger than the kitchen. It's possible to become bigger, feel a sense of bigness, bigger than a lot of things. One of the things that I feel I've become, when I was a new student of Buddhism, Buddhism was really big, and I was really small. And now, I hope this sounds okay to say this, but now Buddhism is really small, and I'm really big. You know, I'm just like, in relationship to Buddhism, I mean, when I just sit here, I'm just like, I don't know what I am. But Buddhism just seems like a small little thing. And isn't that nice? You know, so it's like, well, you know, you should aim for that. You know, this great world religion. I put so much projection authority into Buddhism when I was younger. This great world authority is like the great father figure. And Buddhism doesn't really exist. What exists is your heart. What exists is your mind and the heart of other people. And that heart can become big. That heart can become free. That heart can become pure and clarified. And so one of the ways to do this is to give yourself over wholeheartedly to what you're doing. But not to do it naively. You have to have some wisdom about what you give yourself over to. And so I'll give you kind of another story. Aesop-like fables of Buddhism. Buddhism has this idea of many heavens and gods, devas. And one of the deva realms is the realms of Brahma, one of the great gods of the Indian pantheon. And Brahma, being kind of an overlord of his realm, has a huge, beautiful palace. And he has in his palace, he has a great courtroom, and in the courtroom he has a great throne. And there's many kind of a little bit more minor gods, minor Brahmas, who live in that realm as well, courtier gods or something. And Brahma is like, but he's the top dog. And so one day when Brahma was off roaming around, away from his palace, a little ugly little runt of an imp, of a troll, called a yaksha, yakka, jumped up on Brahma's throne. And you don't do this. You know, only one person sits on Brahma's throne, and that's Brahma himself. Anybody, it's very disrespectful to take that seat. I mean, that's like, you should not do that. So if any of you end up there, unless you become Brahma, don't sit in Brahma's throne. And so the courtiers, the other gods, got angry. He said, you have to get down from there. You can't be sitting there. You shouldn't be up there. And get down right now. And those court gods gave themselves over wholeheartedly to be angry. And as they did that, the little ugly runt of a troll started to grow. And he grew, and he got stronger, and he got more beautiful. Until he was this large, radiant, beautiful being sitting there on the throne. And these court gods were kind of like, what's going on here? You know, this is getting out of hand. So they went and found Brahma. Say, Brahma, back at home, there's this thing going on, and we don't know what's going on, but we tried to, you know, fix the situation, but it's just getting worse. And so Brahma said, oh, I know what's going on. So he went back home and went into his courtroom and stood in front of his throne and put his hands together in Anjali in respect and said to this now beautiful, large, troll, yaksha, said to him, "I'm so glad to see you. I hope you're well. You seem to fit well on the throne, and I hope that you're thriving and doing well." So he started offering his respect, and he wholeheartedly offered his respect and care and kindness to this troll. And as he did that, the troll began to shrink and get smaller and smaller and smaller until finally, poof, the troll disappeared. At which point, Yaksha went up and sat on his throne. And then he explained to the other gods, and he said, "This troll was an anger-eating troll. The more you feed it anger, the bigger and stronger it gets. But if you offer it kindness and respect, then it doesn't get fed that way, and it slowly begins to dissolve and dissolve until finally it's just dissolved completely out." So it matters what you give yourself over wholeheartedly to. And in any situation, but there's a wide range of choices of what you can give yourself over to. So to simply say that the practice is to really be present for what is, and if you give yourself completely over to what is, it might be a little bit naive because there's a wide range of choices of what's happening in this very moment. So what you give yourself over to is part of the wisdom that's needed in this practice that we do here, to have some sense of what to give ourselves to. So if you're giving yourself over to your resentment, over to your greed and lust, give yourself over to your confusion or your doubt, then you might have a little troll that will get bigger and bigger and bigger and stronger until a day will come when it's stronger than you. Watch out. But if you give yourself wholeheartedly over to meeting that troll with kindness and respect, a different outcome will happen. And so how can you meet something with kindness and respect? One of the ways we do in this practice is we're willing to be present for it, to see it clearly, to recognize that it's there. To see it and be present for it and not be in conflict with it. But also not to give into it, to go along with it. Just to be there, present. See it for what it is. And be respectful of it. I think all the forces inside of us warrant our respect. They're there because of causes and conditions. Many causes and conditions have come together to make them be there. I like to kind of assume that everyone's doing their best they can, and doing the best they can, all these things happen to us in our lives, challenges and difficulties we have, and slowly, some things begin to arise and surface in our psyche, in our minds, that maybe aren't really good things to give ourselves over to. But they arise because of causes and conditions. We don't have to take them too personally. We don't have to be alarmed by them. But it's important to practice with them and to distinguish between how we give ourselves over. I've known people who've done the practice of concentration where they kind of did activities, give themselves over wholly to some activities. Because that's what kind of the Buddhist practice they were taught. But they weren't taught to really track and notice their attitudes and emotions behind how they gave themselves over to things. And they gave themselves over with anger, the resentment, the kind of like the ferocity. Like they didn't realize that they were angry when they were doing it. So the mindfulness practice is very important to notice how we're giving ourselves over to something. I think what was nice about this story of the prisoner was that he was able to put aside his resentment. I think many of us would have a hard time with that because our sense of justice and injustice would have been something very strong. But, he did have 12 years to kind of build up some inner strength to be able to do that, some inner context for that. So, so I think it's nice to think that in any given moment, you have a choice. You have choices, and you have a choice about what you bring your attention to, what you participate in, how you're involved in whatever you're doing. Are you involved wholeheartedly in what you're doing? Do you have one foot out the door? Are you hesitant? Are you there fully for the experience that's there? I know that there are situations in my life that for years I didn't really want to be present for these things, and I kind of knew I was supposed to and I should, and so I would kind of like be there, and maybe from the outside it looked like I was there. But I had to learn to be there and let go of the inner life, which was not really there for it, and kind of just really be there. You know, if I'm going to be there, let's be there in a clean and clear way, if that's what's called for, what's going on. And so how are you? They're there wholeheartedly what you're doing. There's something about the wholehearted engagement of what we do, which is very, very helpful for ourselves. But the second choice is, what do we give ourselves wholeheartedly to do? Are we giving us, what's the attitude? What is the thing we're doing? If we're giving ourselves wholeheartedly over to being angry with our neighbor and going over and telling our neighbor what we think, that has a very different condition that allows a particular troll to grow. And if you give yourself over wholeheartedly to bringing your neighbor an apple pie, that creates very different conditions for yourself, maybe for your neighborhood as well. Which is most conducive? Which is most beneficial? What do you give yourself over to do? So I'll end with a story, another little story from my life. It's a little bit of a non sequitur, perhaps. But many years ago, I was with my youngest son in a supermarket, and he was at that age, I don't know how old, but maybe 4 or 5, where it seemed like wanting things was the only purpose to be alive. And so we'd be walking through the store, and I want that, I want that, I want that. And so I turned to him and said to him, you know, I think that you've been taken over by a desire troll. A little troll, desire troll has gotten in there. And he turned to me and looked at me in his very adult way and said, what, are you kidding me? What? Like, where did you come from? So I dropped it. Anyway, watch out for your trolls. Take care of your own trolls, not other people's trolls. So what fire hydrants do you have that you can polish? May you polish the fire hydrants that you are assigned to. Do a good job. Thank you.